In a series of lawsuits filed Tuesday, the voting tech company Dominion accused right-wing networks Newsmax and One America News Network of spreading misinformation about the 2020 election by accusing Dominion of rigging the ballots in President Biden's favor via their voting machines. These lies have harmed the company, its employees, and its customers. Workers have been threatened, their offices vandalized, and the company has had to spend upwards of $600,000 on security for employees, the suit alleges. In these times of lawsuits and countersuits, libel suits are all around us. What does it take to trigger a libel suit, and what does a plaintiff have to prove in order to succeed? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Robert Drexel, Professor Emeritus of the Journalism and Mass Communications Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, as I said, it is all around us, seems to be even more common than ever, and I suppose that in part does have to do with the Internet and all these other forms of communication, all these other ways of libeling or allegedly libeling someone. But where do we stand today in terms of just the basics of libel and how it's defined and who has access to it?
Sure. Some of the basics really haven't changed for decades, if not longer. And that is the basic idea is that there is a legal cause of action, a civil cause of action, a tort, as we call it, called defamation or libel, or in some cases slander, but we'll just use the term libel throughout. And what someone who believes they've been libeled has to do is make a case for the fact that their reputation has been harmed by whatever language is that's been used, that they have been clearly identified so that someone hearing that language realizes that it refers to them. And, of course, it has to be published. At least one additional party has to hear or read, see the defamatory material. It just takes one in theory. But, of course, obviously, it's usually far more than one. And these days, for the last several decades, thanks particularly to a good deal of litigation in front of the United States Supreme Court, the defamation has to be proved to be false by the person bringing the lawsuit. And in most cases, though not all, that person has to show some degree of blameworthiness or, as lawyers would put it, legal fault. And the degree of fault, the degree of blameworthiness depends on whether the plaintiff is regarded as a public person or merely as a private person for purposes of the libel case.
Do you have to prove as a plaintiff that harm has been done in some tangible way?
It used to be that you did not, that damage could simply be presumed from the fact that you had been libeled. And part of that was the idea that it's very difficult to show tangibly how something as intangible as a reputation has been harmed. Of course, you could prove out-of-pocket loss if that were possible for you, but that's difficult to do. So damages used to be presumed in libel cases, but that all began to change drastically thanks to Supreme Court decisions, particularly the 1960s and the 1970s, which began to require most plaintiffs to actually show some evidence that they'd been harmed.
Is this restricted to living people? Because I can see where you might, malign somebody's deceased father or grandmother or something, and they could make a case that, well, in so doing, you're damaging me?
Yes, it has been confined only to living people. There is no cause of action for libel by someone who is deceased, but it doesn't have to be people in the sense of a human being. It can be a business. In fact, there are many libel suits. You mentioned one with the Dominion voting case that are being brought by businesses or organizations. There's one entity who clearly cannot sue for libel, and that's the government itself.
And there are just a few things said against the government.
Yeah, I mean, and it didn't always used to be that case. I mean, the old concept of seditious libel, which was still very much alive, when this country was founded, and in fact has come back to haunt us more than once in the days since then, was the idea that it could actually be a crime to defame the government and, of course, to defame government officials as well. And indeed, the concern about the constitutionality of seditious libel is one of the things that really led the Supreme Court in 1964 to decide what it did in New York Times versus Sullivan, which we will talk about a bit later.
I seem to recall this case from many years ago. I want to call it the Summit Hotel case, but I'm not sure that's even accurate, in which a celebrity on the radio referred to this hotel as a rotten hotel. Uh-huh. And then the question arose as to, well, can you sue the radio station as well as the guest who is speaking on it?
Well, the answer is, generally speaking, you can. You can sue the party who has facilitated the publication. In other words, you can sue the newspaper if the newspaper publishes a libel that that somebody else has actually stated, maybe in a direct quote or something like that in a news story, maybe a columnist, whatever it might be. It used to be that there was some kind of a distinction made between radio or audio, if you will, libels and printed ones, the idea being that something said orally isn't quite as harmful because it's more ephemeral, whereas something that appears in print has an enduring quality. But that distinction has, for the most part, disappeared. So, again, the bottom line is that in general, everybody in the whole chain of publication could be held responsible.
So if I said something negative about you on Facebook, let's say libelous, arguably libelous, is Facebook subject to a libel suit?
There, of course, is a huge exception and one that's very controversial today in terms of what policy should be. And Facebook could not be sued. I could sue you as the person who actually stated the defamatory material. But Facebook, thanks to something called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, because it's an Internet service provider, cannot be sued. And the reason for that, going back to its adoption back in the mid-1990s, was the idea that the growth of the Internet would be drastically stunted if you could hold the service provider or even websites, specific websites themselves, aside from the Facebooks and others of that nature, legally responsible. They would simply close up shop because they would have so much potential liability that they couldn't afford to do business.
So who all is subject to these things? I mean, we have emails, for example. Email, if I send an email, is that considered publication?
That certainly is publication, except that if you send it via Google, for example, Gmail, Google couldn't be held responsible, but you could be held responsible as the person who actually sent the email. Again, this is sometimes controversial. And very controversial in some contexts these days, because there are attempts, as we speak, to try to find ways to amend Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act to make it somewhat easier for people to sue Internet service providers or interactive computer service providers, as well as the statute says. Because it has opened the door to just an enormous amount of defamatory material, privacy-invading material, and so on. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen.
And similar to what I was asking about earlier, I suppose, talk shows, I mean, there's a high level of spontaneity there. They're
yep.
done live without, I assume, any significant delay.
Yeah, and certainly, again, the person on the show, if you will, the guest on the show can be held individually responsible, but there is nothing to stop a would-be plaintiff, the victim of a defamation, to also sue whatever medium it is that is hosting the talk show. And in fact, although we're getting ahead of the game a little bit, in the Dominion case, for example, Fox News, or maybe the Smart Tech case, I forget which, there's so many floating around right now, one of the arguments that Fox is making in terms of trying to protect itself from a successful defamation suit for things that people like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell have said on the air is precisely that. Well, it was a talk show. There's nothing we could do. We shouldn't be held responsible for that. We'll see whether that is successful.
As far as having a successful suit as a plaintiff, what kind of remedies can a plaintiff demand?
The remedies that a plaintiff can demand basically are all monetary in nature, financial in nature, different kinds of damages. Compensatory damages, meaning exactly what you would think from the term, compensation of some kind for the harm that's been done to your reputation, for the psychological harm that you might have suffered as a result, the specific financial damages that you can prove that you've suffered. You know, if you were a dentist, for example, and you could show a dramatic decrease in the number of patients that you've had since the libel was published, perhaps you can show some out-of-pocket losses. And then there's always the possibility of a jury awarding punitive damages. In other words, damages just to punish you for doing this nasty thing, this bad thing, and sort of a caution to not ever consider doing this sort of thing again. And those can be virtually unlimited. Juries have come in with awards, punitive awards in the millions of dollars. They have tended not to withstand appeal. They've been dramatically reduced on appeal, but that's what you can get. You can't force somebody to publish a retraction if they don't want to. You can't force somebody, let's say, to publish something declaring that the truth of the matter really was such and such. That would be unconstitutional. So it's all a matter of damages.
The truth is not a valid complaint, or it's not a, it's not, is it, let's get to the truth.
Yeah.
I suppose the truth could work in the favor of either plaintiff or defendant.
But absolutely.
I suppose it would be common for the defendant to say, well, you know, you really did this or that, which sure reflects badly on you, but the truth is you did it.
Right. If it's true, there's really no defamation. You're only entitled to the reputation you actually deserve. And I have found over the years that often when people first start thinking about libel, they think, well, it ought to be a very straightforward thing. I mean, it's either true or it isn't true. Once you start giving more thought to it, you start to realize, well, it's not necessarily easy to prove that something is true or, for that matter, that something is false. And it used to be that, again, until the Supreme Court started changing things, it used to be that if someone sued for libel, they did not have to initially prove that what was published about them was false, but rather it was on the defendant in the case to establish truth. Fortunately for defendants, and I think fortunately for all of us, there are also any number of long-standing, long-recognized defenses to libel that don't get us into the mucky territory about truth. For example, if you think about it, the media are full of extraordinarily defamatory allegations every day. Every time you read a story about the police arresting somebody and accusing them of some crime, well, obviously that's going to be harmful to the reputation of whoever that person is. Or if someone stands up at a legislative hearing and says some vicious thing about some political opponent, Gee, if you had to worry about whether or not you could prove it was true or not before you could disseminate that kind of information, it would be very difficult. So we have a defense, for example, that's called the fair report defense. It's recognized in virtually every state, some differences, minor relatively, from one state to another, that says that if you are reporting something that is a report of the official actions of government, such as a city council or such as a court hearing or such as the documents that are filed in connection with a court case, as long as you fairly and accurately report that information and attribute it to the official source, you can't be sued. And that's obviously extraordinarily important to all of us in terms of being able to understand what's going on in government.
Now, I've come across this term fair comment, which seems to apply, you're almost, commenting on a work of art or something, mm-hmm. In the context of criticism of some kind that's legitimate, even if it's a matter of opinion. How does that play into libel suits?
That's also a long-standing defense, and it has its roots again in precisely the example that you were describing. The idea is that if someone is seeking public attention for something that they have done, whether it might be a work of art, whether it might be a book, whether it's a play, whether it's whatever, anything you can think of, whether it's touting your restaurant or whatever, you risk that you may be criticized as well as praised for it. And so the idea is that as long as there is a factual basis underlying the opinion of the critic, in other words, the critic had better have eaten at the restaurant before bitterly criticizing the restaurant, as long as there is a basis in fact underlying it, an opinion is not going to be subject to a libel action. Which, again, is extraordinarily important because I think everyone would have to agree, that's always a dangerous statement, of course, but that opinions can be just as harmful, in a sense, to people's reputations or businesses' reputations as statements of fact. But we do protect opinion, and that has also, again, become important in the constitutionalization, if you will, of libel defenses that we can talk about a bit later.
I've also heard just very recently about the strategic lawsuits against public participation, but what does that refer to?
Slap suits, as they are called, yeah. And that's the idea or the problem, if you will, that there have been a good many libel suits over the years that have been brought seemingly to harass people. So if somebody doesn't like a particular development, let us say, that's being proposed in a city and they're trying to stop it, all of a sudden they might find themselves sued for libel by the developer. And the goal of the suit is really not to collect damages for reputation, but the goal of the suit might actually be to get the opponents to just shut up and go away and give up. And this has led legislatures in a good many states, I couldn't tell you precisely how many, but a growing number of states to adopt statutes that are called anti-slap statutes. And the idea is that, and they take slightly different approaches depending on the state, but the idea is that you make it possible for a defendant in cases like that to put an end to the litigation very early on, before it goes on for very long, before it becomes expensive. And so the defendant will go to court and the lawyer will invoke the anti-slap statute. And again, we can't go into the details, but if the judge is convinced by the argument, that'll be the end of the suit.
Hovering over all of this is the First Amendment, and let's look at the impact of the First Amendment on libel when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Robert Drexel, and we're looking at libel libel law as it is in the United States today has changed over the course of time. And a big factor in libel law would be the First Amendment. And I think particularly of newspapers when I think of the First Amendment because, you know, the freedom of the press and the First Amendment. And yet there are libel laws against newspapers.
Well, I think you're right. At least those of us who have been around for a while think about newspapers first. But actually, we should think about all sorts of media. Libel, of course, can occur in lots and lots of different contexts. So it could occur in a newspaper story, of course, or an editorial or something like that, or it could occur in a television news broadcast or a documentary or something like that. But it can also occur in the context of a political campaign with candidates essentially seemingly defaming each other. It can occur in advertising. Indeed, there are a good many libel suits that may result from advertising. Although it's a bit of a digression and probably no point going into great detail about it. About here, there's even such a thing as now being called in some places veggie libel, which is to say libel suits that are being brought on behalf of certain agricultural industries and products. You know, somebody says something. In fact, this happened to Oprah Winfrey. She said something on the air that was not taken well by the beef industry in Texas, and she was sued under one of these agricultural libel laws, the constitutionality of which may be highly questionable. So there are all kinds of contexts in which it can occur, and in the Sullivan case, which we'll talk about in a bit, it was actually an advertisement. In this case, a political kind of advertisement, if you will, that led to what I think it's still fair to say is the single most important libel case ever decided by the United States Supreme Court.
Was it one candidate making statements, allegedly false statements, about another?
There have been cases like that subsequent to New York Times, but in the case of the Sullivan case, it was an advertisement that was placed by a civil rights group, both criticizing the behavior of law enforcement and other entities in the South during the civil rights movement era, and asking in the process for donations to assist with its efforts. And it was out of that particular advertisement, or advertorial, as some people might call these things, that the Sullivan case itself emerged. But there have been other cases before the Supreme Court where, indeed, one candidate for office may have sued another.
What was the upshot of that? Was it someone on behalf of law enforcement that was suing the civil rights organization?
Well, let me take a step back here and sort of walk you through the Sullivan case itself. Remember that particularly until the Sullivan case came along, the idea was that essentially plaintiffs had a great advantage in libel suits in general. They had the advantage of not having to prove that a libel was false. That is, the defendant had the obligation to prove it was true. It wasn't necessarily required of the plaintiff to show at the outset that the libel was false. Remember that damages could simply be presumed. And so if indeed it was determined that a defamatory statement had been published about the plaintiff, then the only question was how much money is the plaintiff going to get, because damages could be presumed by the jury, and the jury could pretty much do whatever it pleased. So it was an area of law that was friendly to plaintiffs, which is the case in many countries, the UK, for example, even today. And not only that, but that until the Sullivan case came along, the law simply created the fiction, if you will, that libelous material didn't really count as at all as the kind of speech or press that was protected by the First Amendment. It was essentially put into a category, and there have been a few other categories that the courts have established over the years that are like this, but it was put into a category of speech that simply had no First Amendment protection whatsoever. It just wasn't a First Amendment issue. If you were sued for libel, good luck if you tried to claim the First Amendment as a defense.
Fascinating.
The Sullivan case changed that in a heartbeat, and that change alone was just extraordinarily significant.
This was when, 1964?
This was 1964. Mm-hmm. And what had happened in the Sullivan case was that the group, the entity that was responsible for the advertisement that the Times ran, took its advertisement to the Times advertising people. And they gave it a look, and they recognized, as I recall, some of the people who were signatories to the ad and brought the ad in and so on. And so they published the ad without investigating the accuracy of anything in the ad, and probably didn't give it too much of a thought. Well, what the ad included was a description of a variety of things that particularly law enforcement agencies in the South had been doing to make life miserable for civil rights protesters and activists. And it included such things as the authorities had thrown a ring up around a particular college campus, that they had padlocked the cafeteria, for example, that they had harassed Martin Luther King by arresting him 7 times, that they hadn't looked into a couple of attempts to bomb. I think in this case, I can't remember every detail, but the Reverend King's house, and so on. And some of these things were factually incorrect. The police had not technically ringed the campus. There was an allegation that a certain song was sung on the steps of the Capitol, state capitol, by protesters, but it was actually a different song. The cafeteria was not actually locked. Dr. King had been arrested 4 times, not 7 times, and so on and so forth. And the guy who was the police commissioner, which is to say the elected official who was technically the head of the police department in Montgomery, Alabama, who was not named at all in the ad, brought a libel suit against the New York Times and also against several of the people who had signed this advertisement. Some, if not all of whom, didn't even realize their names had been included, as I recall. But the big lawsuit was against the Times, which circulated, by the way, only a handful of copies in the state of Alabama. But Mr. Sullivan, the commissioner, made the argument that since this advertisement said some nasty things about law enforcement in Montgomery, that was the same as identifying him, and that people looking at that ad would assume that all of these things were his responsibility, and therefore he had been defamed by these falsehoods and these allegations, so he sued for libel. And a jury in Alabama came in with a damage award of $500,000. I don't know what that is in today's terms, but it would be several million dollars without question. The Times, of course, had no defense, if you will, because could they prove truth? Well, of course they couldn't,
because there
were obviously there were some falsehoods in the ad. could they claim the kind of defense that I talked about earlier in terms of a fair and accurate report of a government proceeding of some kind? Of course not, because there was no proceeding that they were reporting on. Could they claim that it was opinion? Well, the problem is there were factual mistakes, and that was the basis of the lawsuit that Sullivan brought. So they were in a difficult position. So on appeal, which they first lost at the level of the Alabama Supreme Court, on appeal they embarked on the strategy of trying to get the United States Supreme Court to remove libel from the category of material not protected at all by the First Amendment, and to actually save them from liability in this lawsuit. And incidentally, there were a number of other lawsuits pending in other jurisdictions in the South at the time that were very much like this one. But that's what the Times had to do, was convince the Supreme Court that it would be a good idea to essentially turn the law of libel as it currently existed, turn it upside down.
That's a heavy lift.
And it was an extremely heavy lift. And the lift succeeded. And the Supreme Court unanimously came down on the side of the New York Times, and in a variety of ways really significantly changed the law of libel. One of the things that the court emphasized was that what really was happening here, if you permitted Sullivan to bring this libel suit successfully, was essentially you were using the civil law of libel as a backdoor way of actually permitting actions for sedition. Because if you think about it for a bit, you could pretty easily make the argument that what this lawsuit was about was somebody criticizing the government, and of course criticizing a government official, but really it was about criticizing the government. And the Supreme Court actually went so far as to say in passing in the Sullivan case that even though the Sedition Act of 1798 was never tested in the courts, we assume now that it would have been unconstitutional. And so they really bought into this analogy to sedition that the Times was suggesting. And it bothered them, and one of the reasons they saw it as a sort of sedition case in disguise was the fact that Sullivan himself had not been identified in the advertisement at
so
all.
So it was criticizing the government, not that individual.
Yes, yes. So they really leaned on that analogy, and they also made the point that it's extremely important in a system, a representative democracy like we have, for people to feel comfortable speaking out on public issues, criticizing public officials, without having to worry constantly that they could be sued for libel. And if there weren't strong protection for citizens, for media, then there would be this thing called the chilling effect on speech. People would be reluctant to speak out, and that would be a very bad thing. And so they had this famous language about debate on public issues needs to be robust, wide open, and so we need to do something to the law of libel to make sure that we don't have this chilling effect. And what they did was to decide that henceforth, if a public official brings a libel suit for criticism of that person's public actions, official actions, that public official is going to have to essentially prove not only that the libel is false, that the statement is false, but, and here's where the real rub comes in for plaintiffs or would-be plaintiffs, you have to prove that whoever published that libel in their own minds knew that it was false.
That there was some malice?
That, yes. And unfortunately, they used the term actual malice for this idea that you had to show that it was published knowing that it was false or with reckless disregard for the truth, which later they said means you seriously doubted the truth.
Also tough to prove, I would think.
Very, very hard to prove. How do you get inside
somebody's mind.
Head?
Yeah, right.
You know, that's a really difficult thing. And it's become controversial. It has been controversial over time, and it's getting a lot more attention again right now. Has this made it too hard for public officials and others to win libel suits? But that's what you had to do after the Sullivan case, and essentially that's what the Supreme Court intended to be the case. So so many ways in which it changed the law of libel, but again, the most important was that it made it very, very difficult, not impossible, but very, very difficult for public officials to win libel suits that involved any kind of material involving their character or their official actions.
Speaking of official actions and public actions, let's look at a couple of notable, fairly recent cases when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Robert Drexel, and we're looking at libel law, and we've determined that a big case in 1964, New York Times versus Sullivan, expanded the First Amendment defense in libel cases. We mentioned early on, too, much at the beginning, about this case with the Dominion voting machine. Now, Dominion is not a government official. But I guess as a corporation, it is an individual, and that gives it the right to sue for libel if somebody maligns their honesty in their use of their voting machines?
Yep. And the question also is, how is it that an entity like Dominion, a business, if you will, can get involved in a libel case that ends up involving the First Amendment? And to answer that, in a sense, we have to take a step back to the aftermath of New York Times versus Sullivan. As you might guess, as soon as you get a new Supreme Court precedent as dramatic as Sullivan, as you might guess, lawyers are going to start pushing the boundaries and saying, well, this was a great idea in the Sullivan case to provide a First Amendment defense to people who sue, but who are sued. But, you know, there must be other contexts in which it would be just as sensible to do that. And so we had a whole series of cases reaching the Supreme Court over the next several years in which the court said, you know, we're not just going to confine this idea of requiring plaintiffs to prove actual malice, reckless disregard for the truth, publication of a knowing falsehood. We're not just going to confine that to cases being brought by public officials. We're going to expand it to cases that involve public figures more generally. There are lots of people who are so prominent and so powerful in society, for example, that it would make sense to make those kinds of people also prove this thing called actual malice in a libel case. And so they did. They expanded it to include cases being brought by public figures, not just public officials. And then they took an even further step, ultimately, and said that actually we're going to make these requirements binding on anybody who's libeled in the context of any matter of public interest, whether you're a private figure, whether you're a public figure, whether you're the president of the United States, it makes no difference. But at that point, the justices started to disagree with each other. And that was not, as we call it, a majority opinion, where we had a majority of the justices agreeing on who wins and why, but it was controversial even within the court itself. And so ultimately, they came to the conclusion that it should be easier for people who are not public figures or officials, it should be easier for them to sue. There should still be a First Amendment interest taken into account, but henceforth, if states want to, they can permit private individuals who are libeled to win if they can just prove negligence, not actual malice. And the difference of negligence is simply that negligence, it doesn't matter what you're thinking. What matters is whether a jury concludes that you weren't acting the way a reasonable person would have acted.
Like, I suppose, for example, from a journalistic standpoint, if you just single source a statement rather than checking multiple sources to verify it.
Exactly. Whereas in the Sullivan case, for example, the Supreme Court says, well, failure to investigate, that's not the same thing as actual malice. Or refusing to retract, that's not the same thing as actual malice. With negligence as the standard, that might be evidence of negligence. Your failure to investigate journalistically, that might be negligence. So it'll be easier. They tinkered with the law in a variety of other important ways, too, in terms of damages. They said no more presumed damages, even for private individuals. In any case, they made it a little bit easier for private individuals to sue. So to get back to this Dominion case, for example, here we have a corporate entity suing, which has always been the case. Businesses can, of course, sue. But one question, of course, would be, are they public figures? Are they going to have to prove actual malice, or are they private figures? And, of course, they would probably like to be regarded as private figures, but that's probably not going to happen.
Well, I would think in the Dominion case, if you're in the news as providing the voting machines in a controversial presidential election, it would be very hard to prove the case that you're private entity.
It would, and it probably will be in this case. But again, one of the problems and complexities that the Supreme Court has created in its treatment of libel in a variety of contexts is, as soon as you say that there's going to be a difference in treatment between public people and private people, you've got to define what you mean by a public person. And that is an enormous struggle in and of itself in many cases.
Sure. I mean, I can see, for example, if you were on a call-in show once, you could arguably be still a private person. But if you appeared on, say, once a month for a couple of years, you obviously are a public person. And so we're splitting hairs somewhere in between there.
And it may or may not be obvious. I mean, what the courts have tended to do, including the Supreme Court, is to say, well, with the kind of person who might just become involved in something once or twice, the question is going to be, have they voluntarily injected themselves into some kind of a public controversy in order to influence its outcome? That may or may not apply, even with somebody who's been on a talk show or something. It's all going to depend on the context and the facts in the specific case. Or there may be some people who would seem unfair to regard as private individuals because they've played a really central role in some controversy, public controversy, even though they may have done nothing to purposely enter the controversy to try to influence its outcome. So there's a whole category of involuntary public figure that the courts have wrestled with in many cases. So that issue itself becomes a huge one. So you've got the issue of is it a private person? Is it a public person? How do you decide? Is it a false statement of fact? Is it a statement of opinion? If it's opinion, it's not actionable. If it's fact, it is. Is it negligent? Is there evidence of actual malice? It's a nightmare, frankly, and it can take years. I mean, a libel suit can go on for 5, 6, 7 years, and at that point, you have to say to yourself, what's the point of this? If somebody's originally suing because they feel something false about them has been disseminated, it seems like that's the last thing in the world that the courts are ever going to address.
I suppose there'd be a little bit of irony in it, too, if the case itself creates such publicity that the plaintiff is constantly in the news in this negative light.
That's exactly right, and that's something that tactically any would-be plaintiff has to consider. You know, maybe I'm just going to bring more attention to this. And you combine that with the old saw about the truth seldom catches up with the lie. And then maybe you become a bit more sympathetic to some plaintiffs.
Did Sarah Palin sue the New York Times?
Sarah Palin did sue the New York Times. She's still suing the New York Times. The case is still not resolved. She lost initially, and that got reversed by an appeals court, and now it's back in court again. And this is a case that involves a New York Times editorial that essentially said that it had been shown that Sarah Palin's political advertising had triggered the shooting of Representative Giffords, I believe.
Gabby Giffords.
Gabby Giffords. And that was false. And the Times retracted after it was pointed out. The case is still pending and may well go to trial.
Wasn't there a case also connected with that documentary, Making a Murderer?
Making a Murderer. In fact, we just had a decision within the last couple of weeks in court in Wisconsin where one of the deputy sheriffs brought a libel suit against Netflix for Making a Murderer. This was the case involving the documentary involving the Stephen Avery case. And the deputy is saying that that he was defamed in this documentary because it gave the impression that he had planted evidence and engaged in illegal conduct in terms of framing Avery essentially for the murder. And Netflix had made a variety of motions to get the case tossed out, but those were rejected at this level. And so that case conceivably may yet go to trial as well. The deputy in this case, I believe, is being regarded as a public official or public figure. I'm not sure whether that's going to be an argument in the case or not.
There's also a case out there with a great name. I don't know what the outcome will be or even what the tenets of it are, but Pink Slime.
Yes, the Pink Slime case. This was the case that was brought against, a libel case brought against ABC after its reporting on this additive. I can never remember the exact name of it, but Pink Slime was its nickname. It was the technical name is Lean, Finely Textured Beef. And it is beef. It is indeed beef. It's trimmings from things that otherwise can't be used, and it's frequently added to particularly ground beef. And it got the nickname Pink Slime. ABC, I don't believe, gave it that nickname, but kept referring to it that way. And the company Beef Products Incorporated, that was particularly singled out for making and using this product, sued ABC claiming that they had falsely, in their reporting, left the impression that this pink slime wasn't beef, that it wasn't nutritious, that it was dangerous in some way or another, that people shouldn't eat it. Their allegation was that as a result of the stories They ended up having to close plants in several states, lay off several hundred workers. It was devastating for their business. The case actually went to trial in South Dakota, in a small town in South Dakota. And sometime several days, several weeks into the trial, all of a sudden ABC settled the case for what was later reported as $177 million. So we'll never know what a jury would have actually decided, and ABC Disney has never explained why they would be willing to pay out that kind of money, but that's what happened.
How is the Supreme Court looking at this whole Sullivan case and this expansion of First Amendment defense?
The Supreme Court seemingly lost interest in libel cases quite a few years ago. So it's been a long while since the court has wrestled with a garden variety kind of libel case. But a very interesting thing has been happening relatively recently, and that is we have not just one but two Supreme Court justices who have filed opinions in the context that you don't terribly often see extensive opinions filed, and that is in the process of the Supreme Court deciding whether or not to accept a case. And the two justices are Justice Thomas. He was the first to do this, but now also Justice Gorsuch has done this. They have filed opinions basically saying we need to reconsider even New York Times versus Sullivan. Justice Gorsuch it basically says things have changed dramatically when it comes to the media environment in the years since New York Times versus Sullivan, and we should take a case in which we stop and think through whether the very rationale of Sullivan makes sense any longer in an environment in which we have enormous public access to media that can reach literally the entire globe. And he's not suggesting what if any action that should be, but he's concerned about it, and he's worried, at least by what he expresses, that the Sullivan case may kind of be backfiring now, and rather than encouraging more speech, it may be rewarding bad speech and rewarding the most reckless of speakers and so on. Justice Thomas's approach is slightly different, but predictable in his case. He's an originalist. Who will always argue that the Supreme Court should try to figure out what the Constitution meant, what the framers meant at the point at which the Constitution, or in this case the First Amendment, was adopted, and then apply those standards. And so his argument is, hey, libel didn't have any First Amendment protection. Nobody thought that it was protected by the Constitution at the time when the First Amendment was adopted. So the whole premise of New York Times versus Sullivan is based not on law at all, but it's simply a policy preference that has been expressed by the Supreme Court over the years, and we should revisit that. So there's a lot of nervousness, I think, in some quarters among media, worried about whether in the right case, Sullivan itself could be reconsidered, but we shall see.
Robert Drexel, it's been a pleasure. It's been very informative and thought-provoking.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time for University of the Air.